The Institute on Religious Life and the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence of Chicago bring you the following in a series of lectures given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., on the theme, The History of Religious Life. Father John Hardin is a professor of theology at St. John's University in New York. He is a well-known lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin is the author of many articles and books, including Holiness in the Church and the Catholic Catechism, which has been strongly endorsed by Holy Mother Church. In the following lecture, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, St. Francis de Sales and St. Jane Frances de Chantal. Father Hardin.
The spirituality of St. Francis de Sales . The written sources are fairly well exhausted in the lineup that I give there. Notice the number of letters that he wrote. 2,000 letters of Francis de Sales we still have in existence. What is the significance of St. Francis de Sales? May I first ask whether when we talk about the spirituality of St. Francis de Sales, we are talking about Salesian spirituality? Sister? No. What does Salesian spirituality mean? The spirituality of home. Well, now, you're absolutely right. What of what saint who founded the Salesians? Saint John Bosco. Okay? Both the men and the women. First of all, Francis de Sales built on Saint Ignatius. Notably, of course, his spiritual exercises. And Ignatius' stress on human liberty. He found out, and he was the one who has ever since been saying, and as one of those passages in Introduction to the Devout Life, that the real difference between saints and would-be saints is that those who are saints voluntarily cooperate with God's grace. The has-beens, pardon me, the would-have-beens, are those who have the grace but did not cooperate. Second, his spirituality is the product, first of all, of a bishop who was moreover very active in the Episcopal ministry. He was especially effective in converting many Protestants to the Church. Figures seem sometimes exaggerated, but the biographers keep repeating, in the neighborhood of 70,000 converts. As a bishop, he was extraordinarily active in the Episcopal ministry, particularly in convincing those many Protestants that God loved them. Because you recall, somewhere along the line we've touched on this, either in this class or the other one, that in Calvin's vision of God, and Calvin is the great Father in God, you might say, of classic Protestantism, God from all eternity foresaw whom he would predestine for heaven and whom he would condemn to hell. But where Calvin parted with historic Catholicism was to claim that God not only foresaw, but foreordained. And thirdly, that God foreordained some for heaven and others to hell, irrespective of their conduct. In other words, it is not that those who would go to hell would go because God foresaw that they would abuse the graces, but rather that for his own glory, he wanted some to vindicate his justice and some to vindicate his mercy. That's Calvin. DeSales was brought up in that mentality. And by the way, the Swiss and French mentality goes very strong in the direction of Calvinism. In France, as you know, they became the Huguenots. At any rate, it's all very well, we're not talking as Catholics, it's all very well to say that God predestined some people for heaven and others to hell. If I can subjectively convince myself that I am one of those that God has predestined for heaven, that's great. Then I am happy on earth, and I'm going to be happy after death. The trouble is that not everybody, well, is all that convinced. DeSales was not convinced at all. He was convinced, if he had any conviction, that he was on the, I should have put this, but if I paste it this way, it is on the left side. DeSales, therefore, in his own life, was discouraged. He was despondent. And he saw that this kind of predestinarianism makes for discouragement and finally despair, because, and this is not an unimportant feature of his spirituality, the essence of hope is not only trusting in God's goodness or his grace, it is also trusting that I have the freedom and the willpower to shape my destiny. Does that make sense? That's why, by the way, he wrote his famous treatise on the love of God. There are two great books in Christian hagiography on the love of God, Bernard and DeSales. Now, DeSales wrote the way he did on God's love in order to make sure that no one would despair, not despair either in conjuring up a God who would have the demonic gall of condemning some people, irrespective of their merits, to hell, but also of a God who so loves man, and this is DeSales through and through, who so loves man that he gave man the freedom by which he is to love God in return. Because the love of God, and this is DeSales, the love of God is not only God's love for us, it is also our voluntary and free and deliberate and responsive love of God. Number three. The spirit of St. Francis de Sales can be said to be synthesized or capsulized in the order of the visitation. I commend to your reading, if you haven't done it, something about the origins of the visitation order. I know it quite well. I may have mentioned somewhere along the line, after I entered the order, my mother wanted to become a Visitandine nun. I did tell you, didn't I, that I wrote a letter of recommendation, which didn't work. The Visitation Order is an order. Therefore, they take solemn vows. Francis had hoped that the visitations would be the breakthrough among women's religious communities that would engage in the active apostolate outside the community as religious. He did not succeed. But his ideas and his spirit opened up for Vincent de Paul that we will take next. It is also interesting to note that officially the Church considers Francis de Sales the founder of the Visitandine nuns. Now, no doubt, Francis wrote the rule, but it's also a tribute to Saint Jane Frances de Chantal. In other words, her humility. As a matter of fact, he did not have all that much contact with her. He was a busy person. Not too often did he see her, and the correspondence was not that frequent, which says something. It is, as you know, one of the great stories of spiritual direction in the history of the Church. Francis de Sales counseling Jane de Chantal. Aware of a divided Christendom, Francis de Sales, like Ignatius, represents a spirituality in modern times. Because whatever else is true of the Christian world since the 16th century, it is a divided Christian world. And that, consequently, we should be concerned, and part of our apostolic zeal should be towards converting, as we still may say, or bring back to full communion with the Church, which is more theologically accurate, those who are Christians but not Catholics. I don't hesitate saying, and I mean it, the quality of every community founded since the 16th century should include a concern for our separated brethren. In many ways, for example, this community, you're mainly Catholics, right? The girls here, but not only. Am I correct? No, there are all kinds of prudence and concern. All I'm saying is that our concern is not only for those who are Catholic, but also for those who, though Christian, are not, as we say, of the household of the Catholic faith. He is the heavenly patron, so declared by the Church, of the Catholic press. He was the first great pamphleteer. This is about a century, a little more, after the discovery of print. He saw the Protestants using the printed word to weaken and even destroy the faith of believers. He wrote extensively. Desire to combine contemplation of the active apostolate for women. We referred to that before. He did, however, get a number of concessions, though he never got the full concession of having women be religious and yet engaged in the active external apostolate. He made the rule for the Visitandines, though strongly contemplative, remarkably, if I can use the word, easy. Now, by easy, I don't mean it was child's play. But, unlike Teresa, he did not stress, in the pursuit of contemplation, mortification, penance, solitude, silence. He stressed rather affectivity, the intention that I have with which I do whatever I do. He is a great apostle of doing things out of love for God. And you will grow in the contemplative spirit provided you keep telling God you're doing this out of love for him, and of course mean it. Finally, De Sales is the author of the great classic on how to reach perfection for the laity. This is, of course, the introduction to the devout life. We can all profit from the book, but its immediate purpose is to assist the laity. At this point, I would like to just mention in passing what I touched on before, but De Sales gives me the occasion for saying more about it. As religious, we are not to be satisfied with engaging in apostolic work, which may be in some either corporal or spiritual work of mercy, and as it were keep our spirituality to ourselves. No. We have an apostolic obligation to communicate the charism of our institute to others. Such things as third orders or oblates or lay associates. Is part of the history of the Church's sanctification. And when we were forming the Institute on Religious Life, according to the norms that the Holy See was giving us, they couldn't have made it plainer in my hours of conversation with the officials in Rome that we want to have involved in the Institute not only religious, but also the laity, the faithful. Because over the centuries, the great, authors of the spiritualities we've even so far seen, and the several more we still have to see, were indeed either founders, or in this case, reformers, refounders, if you wish, of religious institutes. But they made sure that their spirits affected other people. And I don't hesitate saying this, lest I don't have the time, and I likely won't have the time, to talk about this when we come to modern spiritual life. By that time, it'll be April and May, and that's the end of that. I think a large part of our problem in religious active institutes like we belong to is due to the fact that we've expanded our apostolic work. Good work that needs to be done. And in the process, we've had to involve an increasingly large number of the laity. I just happened to check on one occasion the faculty at Marquette University in Milwaukee. So I could quote the figure, I counted them. There were 100 Jesuits on the faculty, administration, and teachers. There were 1,100 lay staff, administration, and teachers. And that proportion, I think, you know what I'm driving at? That proportion, I think, can be fairly duplicated in many, if not most, other institutes. But, my dear friends, therein lies not merely a problem, but a crisis. Either those with whom our religious work, or with whom religious associates, or who in many ways portray and present the apostate we're engaged in to the public as witnesses of what we're supposed to be. Either we take some means, and we must take the means, this is no easy thing, to help those people acquire some of our spirits, or we're going to harm, and I don't hesitate to say, even destroy our communities. And the more the state demands all kinds of degrees and academic training and skills and certification and licensing, the more people work with us and we with them. We're as human as everybody else. I'm afraid that many religious send most of their waking hours in the company of others who are not religious, and less still, members of their own community than among their own. Do you agree? And we better know what we are doing, as I have more than once, sometimes in long reports to the Holy See, pointed out, while they asked, what happened? At any rate, Nicaeus in many ways gives the answer. We are to sanctify the laity and not merely, as it were, use them and hire them to do a job. We go to a quarter of, don't we? Let me start the features. We can finish this up then 2 weeks hence. Let me just mention one, and that will be plenty. Divine love is the primary goal of sanctity. Yet as, if you've read the treatise on the divine love by St. Francis, and as by now you must know, for St. Francis, divine love was essentially that deeply interior affection that the loving soul has, which he called devotion. Devotion is deeply personal, sincere, committed love. As a consequence, the sales that you reread his Introduction to the Devout Life, he talks very little, comparatively speaking, of the kinds of penance and mortification and the heavily structured, even monastic discipline that we've come to associate with other forms of spirituality. I don't really know why, but my own explanation of this is this. I believe that Francis de Sales came at that period in human, especially Western history, when the neat classification of society, the kind of orderly, organized, systematic life that people used to live, was disappearing. He was entering an age of disorder, of confusion, of unpredictability. And he was chosen by God to give us a spirituality that can cope with the disorder of modern society. Am I clear in what I am trying to point out? That we can be sanctified without being all that programmatic, all that organized, all that structured, all that monastically do this at this time and do something else at another time. Now don't misunderstand me. His sales was organized. Don't you think it's good to hear this? But of course this is a condition that I am so deeply in love with God that whatever I do, including Friday, I come back to the New York subways, I can be growing in sanctity because the God that I love is with me, and what is best of all, I am with him. The second of the eight features we are looking at, necessarily, briefly, are that acts of divine love are the primary means to sanctity. Behind this feature is a profound principle of theology. Other things being equal, any given act which I perform, a good act, is that much more pleasing to God as it is performed from a higher and purer motive. Motivation elevates every action. There are, as we say, three determinants of the morality, or in this case, the spirituality of an action: what I do, how I do it, and why. DeSales' great contribution to the history of Christian spirituality is to bring out the importance of the why, that no matter what I am doing, the more my motive for doing whatever it is the love of God, I am growing in holiness because I have, as we say, sanctified, elevated what I'm doing. Third, methodical mental prayer. We know he was methodical from his writings, even his conferences, the parts to it, and subordinate parts to the major parts, his treatise on the love of God, and his introduction to the devout life is systematized. There are three reasons, I would say, for this. First of all, his own natural temperament. He was a methodical person, and consequently you would expect his spirituality to reveal a certain amount of, to use a word, methodism, which, by the way, is why John Wesley was called a Methodist. He was so methodical. We don't use the word to apply to Catholic people like Francis de Sales, though I should say that they have much in common, Wesley and de Sales. First, then, his temperament. Secondly, his profession. He had been, as you know, a lawyer. And the lawyer may lack other virtues, but if he's ever going to win a case, he better be logical. So he was logical, organized, methodical. And thirdly, he was a disciple of St. Ignatius. And after I read it 10 times, I thought to myself, I guess you all figure that St. Ignatius was very systematic, very methodical. Well, he was. In any case, De Sales, being a disciple of Ignatius and a product of the spiritual exercises, he was structured insofar as we can speak of Ignatian spirituality as being structured.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.